Just one thing before we do jump into today's show, and that is my Beyond the Game newsletter. Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides something to stoke your curiosity before the sporting weekend? Hundreds of parents, coaches, and community sport leaders subscribe to my free newsletter called Beyond the Game. Basically, it includes a short insight from me that I've been pondering during the week, a key finding from the latest research I've been reading, as well as a cool idea from one of the inspiring minds who come on this podcast. It's all designed to help you support your athletes to be the very best that they can be. So if that sounds fun, again, it's very short, just a little goodness before you dive into your busy weekend of sport. If you'd like to try it out, just head over to athletedevelopmentproject.com/newsletter. Type in your email and you'll get the very next one. Cool. Thanks for listening. Kia ora and welcome to the Athlete Development Show podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Harrison, sports scientist, coach, and researcher focused on the developing athlete. Welcome into another episode of The Curious Mind. I'm here with my good friend, Dave Wright. And on the show today, we talk about Dave's recent trip to Tonga and what he learned from spending some time in a different culture. We jump into some conversations of gratitude and why creating awareness in our own environments are really, really important for our kids. I share some recent coach development work I did and the use of self-determination theory and how we can use it strategically in our planning. We talk about coaching style and the what versus the how and the why of coaching. Dave shares his key principle of joy. We spend a lot of time talking about finding joy and why it's super important in our minds for our young people in sport. And then we spend quite a bit of time digging into some negative parent behavior that we've been seeing more and more in the environments that we've been spending time in. And most importantly, we chat about some things that we can do about it. So settle in and please enjoy my wide-ranging conversation with Dave Wright. Dave, welcome back to the pod.
Thanks so much for having me. It certainly has. I think a lot's happened since we last caught up, so there's plenty to discuss today. Who knows how long it's going to go?
Yeah, we've been teeing it up and got a few pages of notes, so we'll see how we go. But as always, why don't we reflect on recent times and perhaps, you know, share a few things that are been spinning your wheels, mate.
Well, I guess, yeah, I've had some pretty cool experiences in the last couple of months. I was very fortunate to be asked by Oceania Football Confederation to head up to Tonga to do some work there as part of a new FIFA talent development program they're implementing, or FIFA's funding in the region, and go up there and present to some coaches and deliver a couple of sort of pieces around session design and talent development, talent ID, with a view to supporting a group of coaches who are going to be working with identified players across the islands. And that was a super humbling experience. So that was in April. And
so what was humbling about it? Like I'm about to embark on 3 weeks in Europe conference, and then just catching up with some people I haven't seen for a while, but also just trying to see a few environments and how they do things elsewhere. And so when you go to another land, what do you look for?
Yeah, so I think one of the first things was, just learning some things around the culture and learning about how they work. It was pretty humbling to see, the gratitude of having a pretty organized intervention from people who are perceived as experts coming in from the outside to share some ideas. So it was really well received. I remember watching the, every morning the coaches would get together and sing and then pray before the session, and you know, religion's not something I'm actively involved in, but I guess it was cool to see a group of people who could just come together and sing a song and be all together in a room. Sort of, you just felt like there was good connection and they're working towards something. They're all there for the betterment of football in their region or in their country. Also observations around how the players and coaches interact, and a little sort of cultural piece around it's not necessarily the norm in Tongan culture to demand or criticize openly of players. So from a coaching perspective, that presents a challenge. And then getting out on the grass and working with some of the players and ensuring they had an enjoyable experience was pretty cool. So yeah, sort of left there going like, there's some resource going in there. There's some people up there who are really, really working hard to try and grow a game which is competing against sports like rugby league and rugby union, obviously, in a very small population. And if you can make incremental steps forward through some small changes or coach education, then that's pretty cool. Like, there is a huge amount of potential to move things from where they are and move the dial forward over time. So that was a pretty cool trip and really interesting to then contrast that with coming back into the Auckland landscape, which presented some challenges.
And so was there a clear difference for you coming back into it? Because I'm always thinking about what we can learn from other cultures to bring back into our own. And so is there a drive for you to increase the gratitude back in our own environment?
I was literally on the grass this morning speaking to a group of teenage players about the importance of staying grateful for exactly where they are, where they get to train, the facilities they're in, the equipment they get. And that has stuck with me because, you know, I grew up in Auckland. I can't say I wanted for much as a kid. I had a great childhood. And you go to places like this and it's eye-opening. And I've had colleagues and friends, particularly in the UK, who have gone out to Africa, for example, to coach and come back with a real different lens on things. And I think it's really important to expose yourself to those different environments and try and bring some key things back. So, yeah, gratitude's a big one. Like, trying to make sure that we're talking about that on the grass with players and trying to get them to understand how lucky they are to be where they are. And that's purely by chance, really.
Mm. And is that through conversation, or have you started to actually play with a few specific tools, techniques? I remember we got invited to the Resilience Project talk. I forget his name, but we'll put it in the show notes. And he tells stories of his time over in India, in the real outskirts, and how a young boy completely changed the way that he saw the world, just being grateful for every day. And now we have so much science that actually shows the importance of gratitude when it comes to mental skills.
Yeah. I think at the moment it's conversations. So it's not sort of explicitly going into session design, let's say, where we're living it on the grass. But I guess there's constant reminders, whether it's team meetings or culture sessions or anything like that, where we're just ensuring that there's an awareness, you know, and I think that's the first step. And I think back to my time in the UK where I can often reference kids at age 10, 11, 12 who are getting two tubes and a bus to training on their own from Southeast London to West London or wherever they've got to get to. And then some of the challenges that go with, let's say, being a pretty affluent first world city in the form of Auckland where we're based, where perhaps kids don't ever have to face that battle. You know, they're getting dropped at school, picked up from training, whatever it is, everything's kind of pretty easy relative to other parts of the world. So again, like, that's just an example of inner city London kids, right? Like, it's a very different reality for them day in, day out. And I think just raising awareness as to how fortunate some of these kids are to be where they are is important. And it's a good takeaway from my little sojourn up to Tonga.
It's always something that I think about a lot. We're lucky. I'm lucky. I'm privileged. I live in a world where my kids get a lot of things that you know, without having to work too hard, and we're quite conscious of not providing them. It's more feedback from the world. But we've just started this little thing at home where we've just got a bunch of post-its and trying to get the kids and NRI to notice the small things that we're grateful for, write them down, put them in a little jar, and then whenever you choose, you can go and pull something out that somebody's observed or written about you, and it's a nice little kind of boost of pride or what, confidence, yeah. Lots of these things, and so you get sort of bang for your buck, right? You're being grateful for, and it's in the small things, those are the things that matter the most.
Yeah, and I think walking away, like at the end of that trip, there was just, you know, I don't know how many times we were thanked before we flew back out for the work, and you just kind of think, you know, lots of stuff's going to go over people's heads. Lots of stuff is going to be challenging for people that you present or you demonstrate on the grass. But if they walk away from 3 or 4 days where we're involved with 1, 2, 3 kind of things that might make them think differently about a topic around talent ID, development, session design, whatever the themes were, then yeah, you've probably made a step forward or supported those people to make a step forward. So yeah, it was a cool trip, and there's been a lot going on since then as well. But I'm curious to hear what you've been doing as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting time in terms of balls in the air.
Yeah.
lots of coaching going on at the moment, and it's exciting to continue to blend the integrated approach that I really strive for, both in my own environments, but also in those that I'm helping coaches and organizations to design and create. And so it's a continuous effort to go, what do environments look like where athletes are getting exposed to these different domains of development without necessarily having to be so intentional about it happening. So pulling people out and saying, this is the physical piece and then this is the mental piece. And so, yeah, fortunate enough in my coaching to get the privilege of spending time with young people and trying to create an experience that is truly integrated. And so that's been really fun. But you also get to see a lot of the challenges that kids are facing in the youth sports space. They're really, really interesting what's starting to show up. And they all really resolve back to the environments that they spend time in, be it, a rower prestigious yeah, school around and steeped in rowing history.
Yeah.
and what that means for a young person trying to navigate that, super interesting. And I always are thinking about whether it's the skills that we need to deliver to the young person to help them navigate versus changing the environment. Because I mean, I think back to the resilience research and some real, real cool stuff out of the UK, a researcher called Masafa Saka. Mm-hmm. And he's spent a lot of time looking at resilience from an individual point of view and the skills that you need to develop in order to go into an environment and thrive. But what he's doing now is looking at the environment itself. And a lot of the new literature shows that you can build resilience more effectively by changing the environment. And it's all around the level of the challenge versus the amount of support. And I would say that we're probably getting that wrong in a lot of instances. Mm. And most of the time it's a developmentally inappropriate challenge. So the kids just don't have the skills to be able to face the environments that we're putting them into.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit further in terms of like what you're seeing and what an example of that might look like?
Yeah, for sure. So say, for example, performance anxiety, which is coming up more and more, right? And so there's an assumption that the young person should be able to handle the environment and the challenge is appropriate to their developmental needs. And it's the individual at fault, so to speak, that they're just not capable of handling the environment. So we think that delivering support to the athlete is the solution. And that can help. But what we need to think of alongside that is the environment itself. And so what we're seeing is it depends on the sport, but kids are spending relatively more time in environments where we're asking them to perform.
Yeah.
And performance by default means that we don't want to see mistakes.
Yeah.
And what that means is that when there's that expectation, then pressure goes up, right? But we've got to understand that kids need to learn the skills, and that learning needs to come from environments that are created for that purpose. And so when kids are spending a lot more time in performance environments as opposed to learning environments, so say, for example, motocross is a good example. Mm-hmm. So kids typically are only on their bikes, not all of the kids, but a lot of the kids, on a weekend when they're racing. So when you ask one of these kids, when do you spend time just riding your bike and there's nothing on the line, they kind of look at you blankly and think that you're from outer space,
yeah.
Right? So whereas what we need is, I mean, that's learning. Those environments where kids can try stuff, make mistakes, and there's no negative consequence. And so I think about that, and it's less about teaching the 14-year-old to be more resilient under pressure, and it's more about being patient and getting the ratio of learning to performing more appropriate to their developmental stage.
Yeah, so nice. Like, so much rattling around my head as you're talking. I think the performance thing around making no mistakes is so interesting, because I'm seeing, and I had this conversation with a sports psychologist this morning, is literally so many players in a football context paralyzed by fear because they're focused on this big extrinsic carrot of a win. And I think we might dive into this a little bit more today, but like, it's a difficult one, because you want, in a sense, environments sometimes to have edge, let's say, if we're demanding or working towards performance. But I think what you're pointing to is this like total lack of informal play or exploration or almost joy. And I'm seeing a lot of joy sucked out of the sport. In football, again, that's my lens most of the time, because everything is so structured and so organized. And so, you know, if a kid's in a club context, we're working towards a club game on the weekend. If a kid's in a school context, we're working towards a school performance on the weekend. When are those kids going down the park, putting jumpers down for goals and messing about and playing? And so it's hard, because you do sometimes want edge and you want that element of intensity or challenge. But yeah, that exploration piece is sometimes missing. And I also think the second thing is this idea around emotional control, like expecting kids, especially in their teenage years, to be able to deal with this pressure of performance all the time is madness. Like, the concept of emotional control for me is almost an oxymoron. Like, it does not, it's hard as an adult. So to expect the child or the teenager to be able to deal with those things is very difficult. And I'm wrestling with like how we genuinely intervene to support that. And I think in a conversation we had last week, and you've referred to it again today, you talked about perhaps they just don't have the skills to sometimes navigate these things. And that's not necessarily anyone's fault, but I think that lack of exploration piece is really critical in all of this.
Yeah. And being patient too.
Yeah.
Because I think we can set environments up where there's learning going on. And I speak to this idea a lot in my keynotes, where we don't always see learning. And so when it comes to emotional control, the outcome is a behavior, and that behavior results in usually an increase in performance. So that's what we're looking for. But there's so many steps. And when we think about developmental environments and our job as coaches, it's to understand the process that delivers on the outcome and everything that's important along the way in order to get them there. And so emotional control, like, you have to start with being aware of your environments. And so, and that takes time to build. And so if we're not having conversations about, you know, how you may be reacting under pressure, for example, how was that for you? You know, how did you behave when you felt the pressure, with no expectation that they're going to change it next time, just to build that awareness over time? And that's the thing, right? Like, so, and then all of a sudden we can start, you know, and educationalists are great at this, they'll scaffold the learning over time. And so we just need to be better at understanding what it is that we're trying to do and the ingredients that go in the slow cooker that are going to produce that over time, right? Because we don't think about that. The long game doesn't come into our equation very much at all.
Totally.
Because that performance environment is driving our behaviors all of the time, isn't it?
Yep. Like, and there's pressure on the coach. You know, there's pressure on the coach there to go, well, actually, there is a game this weekend which we need to prepare for. So that's a juggle. And I think the other thing you talk about is this kind of, and we'll obviously get into sort of a conversation, I think, around parents and their role in this and some of the things we're seeing. But defining that outcome that you're talking about, like, what is the outcome? The outcome can't just be winning the game. Yet when parents are potentially paying for their children to be involved in programs or sport, and there's an investment, then there's an expectation they're going to see progress. And I know, I think we've talked about this offline before, but you know, that's one thing to really consider. And I had an email from a player development project member just yesterday in response to a newsletter we put out, saying, completely agree with the sentiments of this newsletter, which was, you know, highlighting some of the negative narratives around before focusing on some positives and ensuring coaches focus on the good stuff. But his point was, well, in Australia, when kids are paying $3,000 a year to play football, then immediately parents are stakeholders and they expect to see this progress. So his challenge as a coach is he wants to support development, but there's this pressure. There's this real pressure. And that's a difficult one in contemporary culture.
Yeah, unless we actually double down on the things that are important and we objectively measure them and assess them, right? Because then we can show progress, because there's lots of things that we can show progress in. And I think if we could do that across the board and generally speak to this idea of sport can develop humans in a very holistic way and show parents that that's what we're doing, then the game will change. Because in my experience talking with parents, the majority, they want sport to deliver that for their kids. And oftentimes they get blinded by the emotional volatility that they have on the sideline, right? But when you're in the lounge room, sitting around a table, having a coffee and talking about what they really want out of sport, and I think we've spoken about this before as well, it always goes back to the humanistic side of development. And so, like, how do we measure communication skills? How do we do that? And how do we put that in our report that we send back to our parents to say, hey, when your 12-year-old started with us, you know, 12 months ago, this was where they were at from an empathy point of view, and now they're here, and we can directly point to our program. Like,
yeah, that's powerful.
That's powerful, isn't it? Like, and people will be quite happy to, you know, give you that 3K to be involved in that program because it's not happening anywhere else.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, there's power. And then I think too, and I'm curious around your thoughts on this, because if we change the system to incentivize other things, so for example, with Isaac's team at the minute, we train one afternoon a week and then we play, but the narrative is all around playing. The kids want to play, they want to participate in the game so that they can play on Saturday, and the narrative around the game is to put more balls on the back of the net than the other team. And so as soon as you turn up without any intervention from me, you know, there's an entrenched narrative around why we're here. And that's the bit that I'm struggling with, is to push back against that narrative, right? But if we change the way that the season works, right? So for the first half of the season, you know, we just turn up at a festival and the kids, and I know this is happening in some clubs, you know, from the ages of 9 to 12, you just turn up and you play and you're constantly changing teams, and there's still competitive excitement because kids want that, but it's not directed so sharply to the outgame of the one game all of the time. And we do that for 6-8 weeks. Then all of a sudden we can create space to talk about the things that actually matter. And so, yeah, like it's really hard to swim upstream in the current climate.
It is. Yeah, it's so difficult because of tradition and because of the dominant narratives and because of increased coverage in the media of sport and what that looks like and premature professionalism and all these things that are so prevalent in youth sport. And for me, it is a systemic issue. It is a whether that's in a sporting system, or whether that, like, in terms of an individual sport, or whether that's the entire sport system. I think we've got to continue to challenge it and continue to shake it up. And it's very easy for adults who are organizing these systems to try and put things in boxes and have rules and regulations around what has to happen. And, you know, there's certain, in the club I'm involved in, there's certain compliance pieces where it's not necessarily difficult, but there are certain things that clubs have to do to have an accredited program under the eyes of the national body. And I guess the point I'm at now, a year or so into that work, working into the club to try and lead that program, is I'm looking at it going, some of those constraints that we are, you know, asked to sort of live by, they might be actually inhibitive of the optimal development environment. So what can we do to work together with those kind of national bodies to go, hey, we've got an idea here that we want to test, which is completely different, or we're going to actually deliberately reduce the training load every week because the kids are cooked and, you know, they don't really want to come in on a Monday night. So we've got to get creative around how we can do that. And within that, again, might present an opportunity to re-educate people around why this program exists or why the sport's important beyond just, we're going to come and train and we're going to work on this moment and we're going to work on this theme or we're going to work on this for the weekend. What about we just come in and the only focus today is just joy? that's all we're going to do. Just going to play some games, score loads of bangers, have some fun. And at the end of it, like they've played, they've learned some stuff inherently because they're in the game. So yeah, we've got to look at those structures and those systems around it, because the broader system still values win at all costs, in my opinion. Like it's out there, it's rife, whether it's school sport, club sport, it's rife, and there's a huge amount of tradition around it, which is why it's still there. And it's hard to break because people love to win. Like I love to win. I was talking to my brother yesterday. I hate losing stuff. Like, but yeah, I absolutely despise losing, but I genuinely look back at my own experience as a player and think, oh, it wasn't that much fun for a lot of the time, and
but
we can do better.
What is it about losing that riles you up?
I just always have been naturally competitive.
Even if you go out and have the best game of your life and you lose,
as a kid,
that feel different?
As a kid, it wound me up. As a player, it wound me up. So whether that's my teens or my 20s when I was playing, yeah. Like if I go out and play cricket and I get out early while I'm batting, or I get smashed if I'm bowling, or if I play golf and I slice the ball because I know I can do better. So it's that expectation and pressure on myself, which I believe largely is inherent. I was never pushed by my parents in terms of sport. They were always like, just play what you want to play, and weren't overly busy around it or pushy. They're just supportive, and I was really grateful for that in hindsight. But I'm so naturally competitive.
When
so
you go out and play a game of golf now,
yep.
Where does the frustration show up?
It's when you have that moment where you know what you're capable of, but you don't deliver on that. And golf is the hardest, man.
So you're not talking about winning.
No, I'm not talking about shooting my best ever score. I'm just talking about playing with a level of consistency.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's different.
It is.
Winning.
Yeah.
Which is that's the bit that we need to, you know, deconstruct. I ran a workshop for some water polo coaches just the other night, and we were actually talking about motivation and what brings kids into the environment, what keeps them there, what does fun look like, all of these really important questions if you want to dig into motivation. And most people listening in will know self-determination theory, and there's lots of motivational frameworks, but that's a pretty big one, and it gets talked a lot too in the literature. Sport New Zealand share a lot about it on their Balance of Better stuff. And just really quickly, like there's three components that contribute to somebody's self-determination, which essentially is, you know, around fulfillment and motivation and staying engaged. And the first is this idea of competence, which is developing skills, or at least the belief that you can with practice and time. The second one is autonomy, which is we need to feel like we have some control over our environments. Otherwise, you know, we get frustrated and we don't feel like we can direct our own destiny. And then the last one is relatedness, right, which all comes back to a sense of belonging. But where we got to in this workshop was we talked about planning using those components, right? And specifically, we were talking about a 14-year-old team, and we know that young females have a stronger need for belonging than young males. Now I'm talking in general, but just based on what's happening biologically. And so like what should the first 4 weeks of a season look like if we were to use self-determination theory as the lens? And then you can start framing things like relatedness as like, this is the most important thing that we need to do for the first X amount of weeks, because building that sense amongst our players is really, really important. Now, what I believe in terms of self-determination theory is that if you can imagine three concentric circles, competence, autonomy, and relatedness, you can adjust the size of those circles based on the needs of the kids and the environment at the time. So sometimes there might be more of a focus on competence, other times more of a focus on relatedness, and then other times autonomy. But when you start thinking about structuring sessions, even just one session, like first 10 minutes relatedness, second 10 minutes autonomy, We're going to give the ball to the kids, and they're going to explore, and the joy is going to come in there because they get to do the things that they want to do. And then we're going to go to competence because we know that we have to develop some skills, and then we're going to go back to autonomy And we're going to finish with relatedness because we want to make sure that the kids feel like they're part of something special just before they leave.
Yeah.
It just changes how you think about the approach.
Totally. And I think if you are tuning in and you want practical advice, like that is seriously world-class, mate, in terms of a practical suggestion, because I'm wrestling with this around program design, like the balance of we want to provide a good experience and we want to provide learning and we want to provide players an opportunity to get better. What does that look like? Versus the kind of actually the missing pieces around street football and so on. And to build on what you're saying, you know, I'm very fortunate at the minute to be doing my pro license with OFC. And we were set a challenge on the last block in Christchurch a month or so ago, where some of the content was around constraints-led coaching, and that provided some really interesting conversation in the room. And, you know, coaches always sit at different ends of the spectrum around how they deliver and the sort of more traditional methods versus more contemporary methods, let's say. And we were tasked with going out and working with a group of players on some scenarios. So it was a match analysis, hypothetical stuff, all scenario-based, but a match analysis of an international team. And then the groups of kids came out and they had to be those teams for that session. And we had to go and show evidence of working together in a team. And we were challenged with doing stuff that we don't normally do. So for a lot of the coaches going out there and being silent, that was one of the things that they did, which was quite cool. A lot of them led with questions, perhaps, as opposed to command or telling, which again, for those working in international football where they might have limited contact time to shape a team up, like that's a difficult thing to sort of put the handbrake on. And at the end of the session, what was really cool was the guy leading the course, a guy called Sean Douglas, who's a top man and a very experienced coach developer. He went around the players and said to them, right, I want you guys to get in pairs now and talk about what you learned today, what you took away from the session. And so you're expecting a lot of the kids to come back with the what, you know, oh, we learned about defending to counterattack. But almost to a T, all of the pairs came back with the how. How the coaches made them feel, how the coaches engaged with them, what level of autonomy the coaches came back with. So it was things like, today it was really cool to be asked a question as to what I thought the solution to the problem was. Or today I really enjoyed the fact that we had to, that the coaches didn't step in too much. And all these little nuggets came out around actually how the coaches behaved. So there was every group had freedom in terms of how they delivered. But it was a really cool experience to see that when you go in with a certain approach and, you know, level of autonomy in that session was pretty high because it was, hey, we're going to create a game that lends itself to this outcome and then we'll guide you towards trying to solve that problem and then we'll test it in an 11v11 and we'll just see how we go. So being very deliberate with our interventions around how we questioned or when we reinforced certain behaviors because the outcome was, you know, the outcome in that instance was we need you to defend to counterattack. So making sure that we're praising them when they're organized or praising them when they're making forward runs and reinforcing those things. And they all came off talking about how they were coached rather than what they were coached, which was a really cool thing to go. We all went in with a deliberate plan around trying some stuff and largely it worked, and you'd expect so with a group of coaches who are, you know, relatively high caliber in this country.
Yeah. And why I love that is because it reminds me of an idea that actually Dan Cook and I played with for a while around sessioned and design that manipulates emotions.
Yeah.
Because what you're speaking to is that the players are talking about how the coaches made them feel.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest driver of behavior change, which essentially what we're in the game of selling an idea and looking at a behavior change over time. Mm. And if you're not recognizing emotions that are in your environments and how you can manipulate those, you're just missing out on a really important lever, right? Yeah, I've got another really good friend who's been coaching for a long time and always comes back to why, how, what in that order. Yet most of the time we lead with what, don't we? But it's understandable too, because if you don't have the what, it's very easy to feel that you're working in a chaotic environment.
It can be terrifying. You know, the what's the bit we can control, right? Yeah. We can write that down. We can do the X's and O's. We can stop, step in, give some detail. Like that's the bit that we can truly control. But When you start stepping away from that, it becomes very uncomfortable for coaches because it's harder to measure, harder to control. And I think that's where there's a real wrestle, because for me, that comes back to what is coaching? Like, what is coaching? And I think this is a question that is largely unanswered. It's a great one to start discussion. And so if you're working in a club or a school and you're working with other coaches, like, sit down over a coffee and have that discussion. What does everyone think it is? Because it can create some cool conversations. And, you know, for me, it's facilitating environments. Like, that's how I would define it in short. It's facilitating the optimum environment to help players maximize their potential. And facilitating is very deliberate, because it's not about me leading or commanding or telling. It's about facilitating. And at times there will be moments where I need to step in and lead and be more direct. There'll be other times where I need to stand back and look and listen. And as you say, set those challenges around different things. Is today just about a couple of individuals? Is it about a social outcome? Is it about, you know, whatever it is, you're going to move around that spectrum. But yeah, I think the what is coaching question is a real challenge. And there's still this perception that it's me standing on the sideline, screaming, shouting, instructing, commanding, praising. And that can all be done with good intention. Like, that can all be done with so many coaches whose hearts are in the right place. But maybe we're doing those players a disservice by being that way, or we're perceiving that we have to be that way. And it's cool to test different ways of doing it.
Those types of activities are really powerful. One that I use, which if anybody's interested, is the one word. So sitting with coaches and just asking them the one word that best describes their approach, their philosophy, whatever it is that you want to call it. And so that how that activity goes is we want to come up with one word. How you get to that one word is both up for grabs, but also an interesting activity to watch how coaches get to that one word, because some will scramble a whole bunch of stuff on a whiteboard or a piece of paper to work through that and then choose the word. Others will sit there and contemplate it, and then all of a sudden it will pop into their head. But every time that I've done that activity, and then as coaches reflect on that one word, it's always about their experiences. And one coach in particular, just recently when we did it, talked about their word was inclusion. And then she told story, and this was a young coach. She was only 18, like early in her coaching journey, real early. And all of her stories were around, I never felt a part of the group. You know, I was always on the edge. I was always outside of the clique or the tribe or, you know, the group of alphas or whatever you want to call it. And so her entire intention when she showed up in front of a group of kids was to make sure that everybody was seen.
So cool.
Yeah, and but hugely, important from and understanding who she is and her approach,
and in a way, like, sad that she had to go through that experience. I mean, great that it now presents an opportunity for her to help others, and I think coaches coach because they generally like to serve others. You know, they like to support, and I don't think there's too many coaches who genuinely go, I'm going to start coaching because, you know, I want to be the next Mourinho. There's obviously ambitious coaches out there, but yeah, I think most people start because they want to help out or they get roped into it or whatever else. But what a cool place for her to start in terms of, you know, an 18-year-old having that much self-awareness to go, yeah, this is how I felt. I'm going to make sure somebody else doesn't feel that way.
Yeah. And the challenge for her, and there's research that shows that as we walk into environments, and if that environment has adopted a particular philosophy, then and ours doesn't align to that, then it's really hard to steer the course that we believe to be true. Yeah. It's much easier just to jump ships, so to speak.
I can definitely relate to that from experience and working in clubs. And I think I've often said to coaches, it's sometimes a good thing to go through. So I think if you step into an environment where perhaps there is that clash, see how you can navigate it, learn the lessons, and then maybe the next club is going to be the one that fits better. But you're never going to, well, not never, but it's a hard thing to step into any role or club where you're going to be perfectly aligned with what's going on. And I know that's a challenge for coaches for sure.
And I think it's a good time to now jump into one of the topics on my list. And it's a big one, but a lot of the same ideas cross over here around parents.
Yep.
And so, Dave, you've been experiencing some interesting stuff with parents recently. So why don't we go there and share a few of those?
Yeah, so I'm pretty happy that we've got to this point in the conversation. It's been largely positive. So, you know, we were quite clear on not having too much of a moan. But I guess there's some stuff that I'm keen to highlight that I'm seeing, again, primarily around the football landscape. But in talking to other people, I know it's prevalent in other sports. Football might be particularly riddled with it at times. But yeah, I think there's a huge amount of challenge at the moment around this balance. I referred to it earlier around parental expectation, you know, when you're paying to put a player in a program or put your child into a program and see development and this wrestle between the game day realities, which we've touched on and you alluded to in a good example with the coaching you're doing with your son at the moment. Yeah, seeing some difficult stuff. I'm seeing parents fighting on sidelines. I'm seeing parents putting extreme amounts of pressure on children. I'm seeing a lot of stuff vocally on the sidelines, which perhaps, you know, is a little unnecessary. I'm seeing as a result of that, and I'm not saying it's exclusively on parents. I think it's more of a systemic issue, which we touched on earlier. Kids playing with a lot of fear and focus solely on the outcome, which we've alluded to. So, yeah, I think there's a huge opportunity around the parent education piece in this country, and I'm sure it's prevalent. I know it's prevalent overseas as well, where we need to really understand the impact of what does it actually mean to kids when their experience of sport is impacted negatively by the behavior of others on the sideline, by the behavior of adults, and we should be the adults in the room. And I spoke to a parent recently who had a little bit of conflict on the sideline, and there was context around that. Like, there were some reasons for why that happened. But one of the things I said was sometimes it might be better just to remove yourself a little bit from the situation, sit further back and sit as opposed to stand. I think that's the first thing. And I think the primary thing that I would say is that how hard is it to go to a sports game where children are involved, sit there, and watch them enjoy their experience? That shouldn't be that hard, but it seems to be, because whether it's I'm a you know, stakeholder in this kind of program, or I've paid for this, or I expect to see progress, or all these things we've touched on earlier, it shouldn't be that hard for adults to go, this is my kid's time, it's my kid's experience, I want them to enjoy, I want them to have those things that you mentioned earlier around those social emotional progressions, around empathy, which you highlighted. I want all those things when I'm sitting calmly at home around the table talking to you about these things. But then we get to the sideline on the weekend and suddenly it's the FA Cup final every week. And I just find it quite sad. I find it quite sad at the moment, the state of affairs that I see and the things that are hitting my inbox every week and the things that I'm having to deal with around youth sport. And I genuinely don't think it should be that way. I think there's a lot of toxic behavior out there right now, and I think it needs to be highlighted. It's just disappointing.
What are the pieces of the puzzle here? Because I think you can attack it from multiple directions, and it is important to kind of wrestle with this idea that the things that our kids do, the parents are inherently involved. And so pulling those two things apart is a real challenge, because and I know this as a parent, like, their experiences at some point are going to be my experiences. And so, you know, distinguishing between those things it's a real challenge. And you need to be very good with why or what this is for, as I talk about a lot. Mm. Because otherwise you step over the line without you even knowing it some of the time, right? So going back to that question, Dave, like, what are the, maybe if we highlight some of the puzzle pieces and then we could talk specifically to some solutions. Yep. While we don't have them all, it'd be worth having a crack at it.
Yeah, look, I think I don't think this behavior necessarily comes from a bad place. I don't think anyone's going there on game day going, I'm really going to mess this day up for my child or for somebody else's kid. Nobody turns up with that. Like, I like to be optimistic that that's the case and that there's – but I think, you know, when we go back and talk about the broader sporting narrative, the stories that are told and the things we value, it comes back to, well, we want to win on game day. And my view is, well, winning can be so many different things. You talked about me versus myself on the golf course. I love using that kind of idea with a lot of players. Is winning could just be you being the best version of yourself today. And the scoreboard is one of a number of metrics that exist at the end of the day. So I think that's important. So I don't think it's done with malice or ill intent. I think we're talking to coaches over the years, like, we know that self-awareness is one of the most important attributes of being a really effective coach, understanding the impact of your intervention. I would suggest, and I'm only, you know, I'm a parent of a 3 and a 1-year-old, right? So I'm learning as a parent too. But I would suggest that being self-aware as a parent is also a really valuable thing. So I found myself watching my kid who's doing a toddler parkour class every week at the minute, where he gets to run, jump, climb, and so on. I found myself experiencing emotion last weekend of, there was another lad in front of him who was kind of blocking the way and slowing my boy down. And I found myself feeling frustrated. And then I thought, dude, like, just step back a sec. This little guy who's just joined the class is just learning. It's only week 4 of his experience. My kid's about 14, 16 weeks into it. So I need to just chill for a second, let the guy jump off the thing onto the mat and just have his little moment. But I felt that emotion. And I spoke to my wife about it after and said, man, I found myself having like a pushy parent emotion today, like for the first time. And I genuinely go there to watch my boy play and jump and have fun. And it's great. And he has a great time. And I don't think it comes from a bad place. I think these things can arise because we all have our kids' best interests at heart. But this might come back to a wider social kind of narrative that could be a reflection of capitalism or competition or whatever else, where it's all about us getting forward and it's all about us as individuals moving forward, making progress, climbing the ladder, climbing over each other if we have to. That's a social issue. And I don't articulate it as well as others. Like, you know, you can listen back to your podcast with Jimmy Vaughan. I'm sure you guys talked about this on the show and he's pretty good at sharing these ideas. But maybe some of those feelings, it is status and elitism and trying to move forward. And maybe we need to be more collaborative and less competitive at times in order for the group to move forward, for the club to move forward, for everybody involved to move forward. So that's a lot of waffle. I'm sorry about that. That's a ramble.
It's important to waffle to get to the clarity. through confusion to clarity. That's one of my first principles, right, working with kids, is sometimes overwhelm is important in order to work through to a point of more clarity. But ultimately, we have to start having more conversations about the integration and how all of these important stakeholders come together in order to get an outcome that we all agree on. And until such time as we put that up in shining lights and we challenge what the status quo says, which is on game day, winning is why we're here.
Mm.
And keeping in mind that parents will typically only show up on game day.
Yeah.
Well, no.
Depending on the sport.
Yeah, there are lots. But practice is typically a time where it's the kids and the coach, right?
Mm. And they're at more of a distance, perhaps. Yeah. They might be there, but they're at more of a distance.
And the narrative around practice is not the same as it is on game day.
That's true.
But so challenging that narrative, having conversations like bringing parents in to talk to them about all of the good stuff that can happen in and around the competition, and being patient with that, because that's going to be a slow drip, right? Like, one parent at a time is how I think about it. But yeah, like, it's a real challenge when we're all operating in our own social spaces. Yep. and those social spaces have got specific outcomes. The corporate world has got specific drivers. Education is built in a way that's got specific drivers. And I always, like, with the work that I'm doing in schools, it's much easier to get parents to come out to a prize giving where we're recognizing achievement than it is to come and have a conversation about development.
Totally. And I think just to go back to your point earlier around the 18-year-old coach learning her craft, like, her mission's inclusion. Like, what a great start point for working with parents as well. Because I think one of the things that often sport doesn't do so well is include them and communicate well enough, and that can create anxiety and stress for parents if they're not sure what they're seeing or why things are happening that way, and we're not communicating that from a club or organizational perspective, then that needs to be better. But I think bringing people together, I think often they just get pushed to the side, not included, not communicated to, and there's so much power in that. And I know you're doing some research at the moment in a particular sport around this piece. Like, have you got any insights to share as to how that's evolving or anything you can discuss around that?
Yeah, so this is a master's thesis and it's going to come out pretty soon. And so, you know, we'll share it on the pod and I'll get Sal, my student, on to come and talk about some of her findings. But yeah, what we did was sat down with a whole bunch of parents and just asked them about their perceptions of the developmental environment. And it was super interesting as to, you know, what came to the surface. But ultimately, there was some good stuff. There was some frustrations. When you talk to anyone about their experience in any environment, then you get the good, the bad, and the ugly. It tends to be sometimes you get more of the ugly because humans like to point out everything that's wrong and frustrating, and you know that's how our brains are wired a little bit. So you've got to keep that in mind when you're doing research like this. And there's always two sides of the story which you have to work through. But ultimately, people speak their truth. And it's truth with a little t, right? And so if they're an important stakeholder and we believe that they're important, then we have to listen to that truth and we have to try and work with it, because ultimately parents play a huge role in the lives of their kids up until the time where they leave home, which in our case is we're not dealing with a lot of athletes that are on their own. They're typically still under the roof of mum and dad. We're seeing a lot of it comes back to being very clear around what we're trying to do, and then speaking that through very good communication. And that's a challenge because communication per se requires consistency. It requires a dialogue that's open, and that conflict can arise and we can work through that conflict, because we're never all going to see things the same way. But I think where you get to with this type of work and in any sort of strategic document or framework or whatever it is that, and most of the time these things don't exist, which I think is problematic, and we need to do a much better job of understanding what that pathway looks like and what are our anchor points. Because then you can draw back to those anchor points, right? With the communication that goes west a little bit, then we can say, well, what is it that we're trying to do here? Mm. What does it look like? And then how do we live it day to day? Because that's the challenge. And how do we keep people accountable to it?
So that
everybody, parents need to be accountable to it just as much as the administrators and the coaches. Mm. Because that's ultimately it's got to be for the children, right?
And that's a massive piece. Like, it's great. And we talked about it recently, but it's great to go and deliver content and share ideas. But not everybody's going to engage. And, you know, somebody might turn up and one thing resonates and somebody might be absolutely frothing on the content that you sort of present. But that constant check-in or that accountability piece, or what are the things that we're going to do consistently and how regularly are we going to talk about it? And I certainly haven't solved this problem. I'm sitting here going, like, I've got some ideas and, you know, could this work? And I'm having some great conversations with some of the managers involved in teams and some of the people around sport to say, hey, have we considered changing this? Or we need to find the balance. And similarly with the coaches, you know, like, it doesn't need to be serious all the time. And I think there are so many parties involved, but yeah, we need to be better at including those people and educating those people who are, you know, putting in so much effort to get their kids to sport, you know. And again, so parents aren't driving around for ages and sacrificing time and sitting in the car waiting at training because that's their choice. They're doing that for their kids. So I think the first thing is we've all got the common ground of coaches coach because they want to help kids. Parents are getting their kids to sport because they want them to have a good experience or they want them to develop. But I think there is a piece where there are unfortunately still parents out there who are thinking, oh, this is an avenue to professional sport. This is an avenue to go and be a pro footballer overseas. And frankly, that is, you know, players that emerge out of this system in New Zealand, they're anomalies. Like, they are absolute exceptions. And we know the stats in professional academy football in the UK, for example, like the chances of being a pro out of the system when you're already in it is less than 1%. Like, lots of kids get scholarships and get their first pro contracts, but do they sustain careers as professionals? Unlikely. And that is a whole different stratosphere in terms of level. And we've got to be real about that. You know, it's awesome when kids come out of New Zealand and go overseas and carve out a career, or they go and get a scholarship in the States and get an education through sport. Brilliant, like absolutely brilliant. We've got to find ways to create pathways and open up those opportunities. But it shouldn't be our first priority. The first priority should be to create a great experience, ensure they're developed, ensure they're connected, and all those things that you talked about around self-determination theory are prevalent through those environments. But if those opportunities come, they'll emerge, you know, at some point. And if you are good enough, you will be on the radar at some point. But we can't be pushing our kids to be pros by training more and doing more and having conversations every time the game finishes about what could have been better and what they did wrong. And I just think, you know, we've got to be a little bit more pragmatic as to where we sit in the world, again, with a football hat on. Because it's a really global game with a huge amount of players around the world. And so to actually crack it and be a pro is super difficult. And so we've got to take the lens off that and shift away from this kind of elitism mentality. And I know there are clubs out there using the word elite in their junior programs. Like, it's rubbish. Like, let's just stop that. Like, let's stop that. It's not elite. These are development programs to help kids have a great experience and connect with the sport. Mm.
And but you mentioned earlier too that some of the stuff is it's unintentional consequence of not thinking critically around what we're
exactly
trying to do. So
yeah.
So as a thought experiment, Dave, like if I was to say to you, you know, what are the three top things that you would like sport to do for your kids over the next 10 years? Where would you go?
I think not dissimilar to what you spoke about earlier, but for the first one, joy. Like, I want my kids to have a great time playing sport, and I know they're going to be physically active, and I'm going to guide them towards that. But
can I interject for a second?
Sure.
Because Anna and I, we've just started mountain biking.
Yeah.
I did a lot of it at university and thoroughly enjoyed it. And all of my experiences of that mountain biking was with one of my good mates, shout out to Justin. And like, if I reflect on those experiences, I think about like the yahooing and the squealing, yeah, and the moments of pure joy.
Yeah.
Like rolling a jump, perhaps doing something a little bit risky and landing it. And there was a few of those. We went for a ride yesterday morning. We got off the bike and we're like, man, that was so much fun.
That's great, yeah.
And then what was fun about it? Oh, it was actually those moments of getting right up to where I know my current ability, because it's not very high at the moment, and just being right on the edge there. Michael Gervais talks about this on his podcast, and just pushing the boat out a little bit more, right? And flow, like it's been described really well in literature, and so we were like, well, that's actually good for my well-being. That's linked to well-being. And you talk about joy. I'm like, well, moments of flow for kids in sport, like, we can optimize for that.
Totally.
You know, so anyway. So
look, I love that. And just to build on that as well, like, I grew up on a bike, you know, grew up riding around where we lived. And, you know, even when I was living in London, cycled everywhere. And I remember a couple of years ago going out to Woodhill, and I hadn't mountain biked since I was a kid. And so it was really interesting to feel that that adult level of risk tolerance come back, as opposed to when you're on a snowboard or a bike as a teenager, you just do what you do. And I relate to that, and remember coming down from that ride feeling very similar. Like, man, I just went off some jumps, or I went down some really tight trails, or almost just smashed into a tree. And I think that's really important. So the joy element's number one. I think the second would be challenge. I think anything that's going to support developing resilience, which you touched on earlier, is really important. I want my kids, if I could say at the end of my life, what are the two things I want to do for my kids, it would be I want them to be happy and resilient. Now, I can't control if they're happy, and there's loads of things that'll be variables around that. But if that's how I'm looking at parenthood right now, happiness and resilience. So things that are going to challenge them, make them uncomfortable, stretch them at the right times, then that's great. Like, that's another great thing that sport can do for my kids. And the third would be connection / memories. You know, I think if you can, I still can remember things from my childhood, football, cricket, other sports that I played, experiences and moments that we had, whether that was individually doing things on the pitch or whether that was scoring some runs with the bat or taking a few wickets. Like, I can remember those moments. So the connection piece, being connected to the sport, connected to the people who you're playing with, the friendships, camaraderie that come out of that. So yeah, joy, challenge and connection for me. Have you got thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think about this all the time. I resonate with that idea of joy, and I go to flow when I think about that. Like, just, and that gets, you know, fairly specific when it comes to that idea and how you actually create that. But that would be definitely one. I think it's day-to-day moments of joy, just more joy in day-to-day moments. As opposed to, and you mentioned it earlier, always looking ahead to the outcome. And then let's sacrifice now in order to get, you know, to the outcome in 5 years' time. It's like, well, so 5 years of water is going under the bridge just, you know, to get there. And I'm not disrespecting hard work and perseverance and all these things. But that's important too. But we can't forget moments of joy along the way. Empathy, for me, is massive. I think that would probably be at the top. So, like, for my kids, I want them to be empathetic and to be able to understand the experiences of others so that they can just be aware and take a moment to go, you know, how I react needs to be somewhat based on where they're at. And I had a conversation with Georgia just yesterday about this. Of her experience in netball and getting frustrated with some of, you know, what was going on and things not working out. And we just had a conversation about the stage of development that some of these other kids were at compared to her. Mm. She's a charger and she loves it. And, you know, she's grown up in an environment with her mum.
Yeah.
So she's at this point in her development, she's further ahead and she gets frustrated. But she needs to learn that that's a part of sport and it's a part of life, and it's just such a perfect context for her to learn empathy. Mm-hmm. But we need to draw her attention to it, because if we're constantly feeding the outcome and the comparisons to others and getting better at our skills,
yeah,
then that's what she's going to turn to every time. She's going to believe that that's what's important. And yeah, so joy, empathy, and then I turn to challenge as well. And there's an idea that in the literature that sort of builds on grit, and they call it hardiness. Mm-hmm. And they talk to connection, control, and challenge. I think it's connection. I might be getting the third one wrong. Definitely challenge, control, commitment is the other one.
Yeah.
Those things are important to me. Is that if you sign up to something, then, you know, it's important to put some effort in. Those things, if we put them up in shining lights and we communicated to our parents that this is what we're about, and then we delivered on them day to day and we asked our parents to be a part of that journey, then I think we can, you know, over time start changing the narrative. It's not going to be easy. Sport New Zealand talk a lot about the importance of brave, courageous conversations. And that's what it's going to take.
Yep.
You know, clubs, schools are going to have to be brave enough to do it differently.
Mm, agreed. Yeah, there's a lot of work to be done. But I think if you can start with that point around what do you want for your kids out of sport with parents, or potentially why are we providing organized sport for kids with schools and clubs that organize it, stripping it back to those key drivers might be a really cool place to start. Mm.
So why don't we wind this one up just talking about any experiences that we've had, you know, helping parents to be more involved and to go on the journey with us. Because I think that for me is really, really important. And in my experience with parents, as soon as you fill the gaps of that misunderstanding of you know, intention, action, outcome that you get, you know, so as parents we see a lot of things happening on the sideline, for example, and but we don't necessarily consider the process that led to that, and be it positive or negative. And usually my conversations are around negative outcomes. So, for example, a young 14-year-old not wanting to engage in a particular challenge, so the parent can see that that's happening, but why and what's the environment contributing to that outcome is not necessarily clear. And as soon as you actually fill in some of those gaps, then all of a sudden the penny drops and we can work with the process. It's much harder to work with the outcome. And so have you had any success with your parents in terms of bringing them on board?
I like to think going into a new season, sharing a presentation last year at the club with some of the parents of the younger players, that it was pretty well received. And some of those conversations afterwards around why we were going down a more inclusive approach, what success for a 9 to 12-year-old player looks like, and really just providing some education. There were some cool conversations on the back of that. And I know recently it wasn't me delivering the conversation, but a colleague had a conversation sideline with a parent around the principles in the program are retain the ball, run with the ball, release the ball, receive the ball. And that's pretty much the program for these younger ones. And there's a huge amount of fun focus with this particular group. And a parent was observed by the guy leading the program around being encouraged to kick the ball out and play safe. And the discussion that followed that was, hey, have you thought about the implications of that on your child as to, you know, valuing playing safe versus taking a risk and trying to retain the ball? And I know I've rambled on about 1v1s and things like that on this show before, but it was literally a penny dropping moment for this parent when they didn't even consider the ramifications or the developmental opportunity that was missed by their child in the game of staying on the ball and doing the opposite of what they'd encouraged them to do, just because they don't know what they don't know and they didn't understand. And he literally said to my colleague, I'd never even thought of it that way. So again, it goes back to, this is a well-meaning parent encouraging, supporting, they're on the day to support their child, trying to do the right thing by them, but hasn't thought about the consequence of that. So that was a good example of us kind of using the four key pillars of the program from a technical perspective as a reference point there. I also, and I may have referred to this conversation before, I remember having a sort of review meeting in the UK when I was working at Fulham. With a player and a parent who there was a huge amount of anxiety around the child. This kid displayed that on the pitch. The dad displayed it on the sideline. And we got to a point where it was almost a watershed moment for this player who went on to stay in the program for another 4 or so years beyond that, you know, which is a great achievement in itself just to stay in that program till you're 16 years old. But, you know, this kid was 12, 13 at the time. The player was really, really suffering with anxiety on the pitch, constantly confused at times. So we were trying to work with this player and be a little bit more direct around, hey, you could do this, you could do that. And the parent, you know, was very, very clear in how much that was valued by the player. But what it boiled down to was this anxiety was all coming from dad. You know, dad was terrified that his kid was going to be released, which I know is an issue in these professional programs for a lot of parents. And finally, when we broke it down and got him one-to-one, he expressed this anxiety, he expressed this fear, and it was about saying, hey, trust the program, trust the process here. And he, you know, broke down in front of us and said, you know, I just love my son so much. I just want him to do well. So it was all coming from a good place, but it was so overbearing and so hard to watch. And yeah, it took, I knew that kid for 2 or 3 years at two different clubs. And he was a good kid, bright kid. Dad meant well. And at that point, this child was also an only child. They had a daughter shortly after that who was 10 years younger than the boy or 12 years younger than the boy. So that would have probably changed their family dynamic a lot too. But this was their only child at this point. And so, yeah, it was a really interesting conversation to see an overbearing dad who just meant well, but it was having a real negative impact. And I think that intervention where he acknowledged he just needed to trust the process and trust the club a bit more, that the club was going to stick by his kid for another 2 years at that point, you know, that was reassurance for him.
Yeah. Stories are powerful. And I always think about the importance of emotion, as I mentioned earlier, when it comes to behavior change or a catalyst to change. And so if we could get that dad to share a story, and that's a really vulnerable position to put yourself into, but like if we could do that, you know, if he could stand up in front of the parents of all of the incoming players into the academy and say, hey, look, this is the journey that I went on, and I'm a completely different person now from when I started, and this was the struggle, then that's going to resonate, you know. And so I would love to see more of that.
Yeah.
You know, just putting our hands up and saying, this isn't easy. You know, like it's when it comes to our kids, it's close to home. And so more stories would be useful.
No doubt being a sports parent in contemporary culture is difficult. So I think, you know, I'd like to think I'm learning to empathize more with parents becoming a parent in the last 4 years. And yeah, it's not an easy thing, and we all want what's best for them. But sometimes we just need to chill out and watch them play.
Amen. All right, Dave, we will continue to think about this space, and no doubt we'll be talking about it on the show again and in future episodes. But thanks so much for taking the time once again. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, mate. Always enjoy catching up. Thank you.